The Celestine Prophecy, Cassette 5.
Engaging the Flow. The two priests walk back to the house, and I spend several more minutes observing the beauty of the mountains in an attempt to gain more energy. Then, I lost my focus and drifted absently into a reverie about Will. Where was he? Was he close to finding the Ninth Insight? I imagined him running through the jungle, the Ninth Insight in his hand, troops everywhere pursuing. I thought of Sebastian orchestrating the chase. Yet in my daydream, it was clear that Sebastian, even with all his authority, was wrong, that he misunderstood something about the impact the insights would have on people. I felt that someone could persuade him to take a different view if only we could discover what part of the manuscript threatened him so. As I mused over this thought, Marjorie popped into my mind. Where was she? I pictured seeing her again. How might that happen? The sound of the front door closing brought me back to reality. I felt weak and nervous again. Sanchez walked around the house toward where I was sitting. His pace was quick, purposeful. He sat down beside me, then asked, "Have you decided what to do?" I shook my head. "You don't look very strong," he said. "I don't feel very strong." "Perhaps you're not being very systematic in the way you build your energy."
"What do you mean?"
"Let me offer you the way that I personally gain energy. Perhaps my method will help you as you create your own procedure." I nodded for him to go on. "The first thing I do," he said, "is to focus on the environment around me, as I think you do also. Then I try to remember how everything looks when I'm being filled with energy. I do this by recalling the presence everything displays, the unique beauty and shape of everything, especially plants, and the way colors seem to glow and appear brighter. Do you follow me?"
"Yes, I try to do the same thing."
"Then," he continued, "I try to experience that feeling of closeness, the feeling that no matter how far away something is, that I can touch it, connect with it, and then I breathe it in."
"Breathe it in?"
"Did Father John not explain this to you?"
"No, he didn't."
Sanchez appeared confused. "Perhaps he intended to come back and tell you about it later. Often he's very dramatic. He walks away and leaves his pupil alone to ponder what he has taught. Then he shows up later at just the right time to add something else to the instruction. I suppose he intended to talk with you again, but we'd left too quickly."
"I'd like to hear about it," I said.
"Do you remember the feeling of buoyancy that you experienced on the ridgetop?" he asked.
"Yes," I said.
"To regain that buoyancy, I try to breathe in the energy with which I have just connected." I had been following along as Sanchez spoke. Just hearing his procedure was increasing my connection. Everything around me had increased in presence and beauty. Even the rocks seemed to have a whitish glow, and Sanchez's energy field was wide and blue. He was now taking deep, conscious breaths, holding each about 5 seconds before exhaling. I followed his example. "When we visualize," he said, "that each breath pools energy into us and fills us like a balloon, we actually become more energized and feel much lighter and more buoyant." After several breaths, I began to feel exactly that way. "After I breathe in the energy," Sanchez continued, "I check to see if I have the right emotion. As I've told you before, I consider this the true measure of whether I am really connected."
"You are speaking of love?"
"That's correct. As we discussed at the mission, love is not an intellectual concept or a moral imperative or anything else. It is a background emotion that exists when one is connected to the energy available in the universe, which, of course, is the energy of God." Father Sanchez was gazing at me, his eyes slightly out of focus.
"There," he said, "you've reached it. That's the level of energy you need to have. I'm helping you some, but you are ready to maintain it on your own."
"What do you mean you're helping me some?" Father Sanchez shook his head. Don't worry about that now. You'll learn about it later, in the eighth insight. Father Carl walked around the house then and looked at both of us, as though pleased. As he approached, he glanced at me. Have you decided yet? The question irritated me. I fought against the resulting loss of energy. Don't fall back into your aloof drama, Father Carl said. You can't avoid taking a stand here. What are you thinking you need to do? I'm not thinking anything, I said. That's the problem. Are you sure? Thoughts feel different once you get connected with the energy. I gave him a puzzled look. The words you have habitually willed through your head in an attempt to logically control events, he explained, stop when you give up your control drama. As you fill up with inner energy, other kinds of thoughts enter your mind from a higher part of yourself. These are your intuitions. They feel different. They just appear in the back of your mind, sometimes in a kind of daydream or mini-vision, and they come to direct you, to guide you. I still didn't understand. Tell us what you were thinking about when we left you alone earlier, Father Carl said. I'm not sure I remember it all, I said. Try. I tried to concentrate. I was thinking about Will, I guess, about whether he was close to finding the ninth insight, and about Sebastian's crusade against the manuscript. What else? I was wondering about Marjorie, about what happened to her. But I don't understand how this helps me know what to do. Let me explain, Father Sanchez said. When you have acquired enough energy, you are ready to consciously engage evolution, to start it flowing, to produce the coincidences that will lead you forward. You engage your evolution in a very specific way. First, as I said, you build sufficient energy, then you remember your basic life question, the one your parents gave you. Because this question provides the overall context for your evolution. Next, you center yourself on your path by discovering the immediate smaller questions that currently confront you in life. These questions always pertain to your larger question and define where you currently are in your lifelong quest. Once you become conscious of the questions active in the moment, you always get some kind of intuitive direction of what to do, of where to go. You get a hunch about the next step, always. The only time this will not occur is when you have the wrong question in mind. You see, the problem in life isn't receiving answers. The problem is in identifying your current questions. Once you get the questions right, the answers always come. After you get an intuition of what might happen next, he continued, then the next step is to become very alert and watchful. Sooner or later, coincidences will occur to move you in the direction indicated by the intuition. Do you follow me? I think I do. So, he continued, don't you think those thoughts of Will and Sebastian and Marjorie are important? Think about why these thoughts are coming now, considering the story of your life. You know that you came out of your family wanting to find out how to make the spiritual life an inwardly self-enhancing adventure, right? Yes. Then, as you grew up, you became interested in mysterious topics. You studied sociology and worked with people, although you didn't yet know why you were doing these things. Then, as you began to wake up, you heard about the manuscript and came to Peru and found the insights one by one, and each has taught you something about the kind of spirituality you seek. Now that you've become clear, you can become super conscious of this evolution by defining your current questions and then watching the answers come. I just looked at him. What are your current questions? He asked. I guess I want to know about the other insights, I said. Especially I want to know if Will is going to find the ninth insight. I want to know what happened to Marjorie, and I want to know about Sebastian. And what were your intuitions suggesting about these questions? I don't know. I was thinking of seeing Marjorie again, and of Will running with troops chasing him. What does it mean? Where was Will running? In the jungle. Perhaps that indicates where you should go. Akitos is in the jungle. What about Marjorie? I saw myself seeing her again. And Sebastian? I fantasized that he was against the manuscript because he misunderstood. That his mind could be changed if one could find out what he was thinking, what exactly he feared about the manuscript. Both men looked at each other in total amazement. What does it mean? I asked. Father Carl replied with another question. What do you think? For the first time since the ridgetop, I was beginning to feel fully energized again and confident. I looked at them and said, I guess it means I should go toward the jungle and try to discover which aspects of the manuscript the church dislikes. Father Carl smiled. Exactly. You can take my truck. I nodded, and we walked around to the front of the house where the vehicles were parked. My things, along with a supply of food and water, were already packed in Father Carl's truck. Father Sanchez's vehicle was also packed. I want to tell you this, Sanchez said. Remember to stop as often as necessary to reconnect your energy. Stay full, stay in a state of love. Remember that once you achieve this state of love, nothing nor anyone can pull more energy from you than you can replace. In fact, the energy flowing out of you creates a current that pulls energy into you at the same rate. You can never run out. But you must stay conscious of this process in order for it to work. This is especially important when you interact with people. He paused. Simultaneously, as if on cue, Father Carl walked closer and said, You have read all but two insights, the seventh and eighth. Seven deals with the process of consciously evolving yourself, of staying alert to every coincidence, every answer the universe provides for you. He handed me a small folder. This is the seventh. It is very short and general, he continued, but it talks about the way objects jump out at us, the way certain thoughts come as guidance. As for the eighth, you will find it yourself when the time is right. It explains how we can aid others as they bring us the answers we seek. And further, it describes a whole new ethic governing the way humans should treat each other in order to facilitate everyone's evolution. Why can't you give me the eighth insight now? I asked. Father Carl smiled and put his hand on my shoulder. Because we don't feel we should. We must follow our intuitions also. You will get the eighth insight as soon as you ask the right question. I told him I understood. Then both priests hugged me and wished me well. Father Carl stressed that we would soon meet again and that I would indeed find the answers I was here to receive. We were all about to board our respective vehicles when Sanchez turned suddenly and faced me. I have an intuition to tell you something. You will learn more about it later. Let your perception of beauty and iridescence lead your way. Places and people who have answers for you will appear more luminous and attractive. I nodded and climbed into Father Carl's truck, then followed them down the rocky road for several miles until we came to a fork. Sanchez waved out the back window as he and Father Carl headed east. I watched them for a moment, then turned the old truck north toward the Amazon basin. A surge of impatience rose up within me. After making good time for over 3 hours, I now sat at a crossroads, unable to decide between two particular routes. To my left was one possibility. Judging from the map, this road bore north along the edge of the mountains for 100 miles, then turned sharply east toward Iquitos. The other route led to the right and maintained an eastern angle through the jungle to the same destination. I took a deep breath and tried to relax, then quickly checked the rearview mirror. No one was in sight. In fact, I hadn't seen anyone. No traffic, no locals walking in over an hour. I tried to shake off a rush of anxiety. I knew I had to relax and stay connected if I expected to make the right decision. I focused on the scene. The jungle route to my right progressed between a group of large trees. Several huge outcroppings of rock punctuated the ground around them. Most were encircled by large tropical bushes. The other route through the mountains seemed comparatively bare. One tree grew in that direction, but the remainder of the landscape was rocky, with very little plant life. I looked to the right again and tried to induce a love state. The trees and bushes were a rich green. I looked to the left and tried the same procedure. Immediately I noticed a path of flowering grass that bordered the road. The blades of grass were pale and spotty, but the white flowers, viewed together, created a unique pattern into the distance. I wondered why I hadn't noticed the flowers earlier. They now seemed to almost glow. I broadened my focus to include everything in that direction. The small rocks and brown patches of gravel seemed extraordinarily colorful and distinct. Hues of amber and violet, and even dark red, ran through the entire scene. I glanced back to the right to the trees and bushes. Although beautiful, they now paled in comparison to the other route. But how could that be, I thought. Initially, the road to the right seemed more attractive. Glancing back to the left, my intuition strengthened. The richness of shape and color amazed me. I was convinced. I started the truck and headed to the left, sure of the correctness of my decision. The road was bumpy with rocks and ruts. As I bounced along, my body felt lighter. My weight was centered on my buttocks, and my back and neck were straight. My arms were holding the steering wheel, but were not resting on it. For 2 hours I drove without incident, nibbling from the food basket Father Carl had packed, and again seeing no one. The road meandered up and down one small foothill after another. At the top of one hill, I observed two older cars parked to my right. They were pulled far off to the side of the road in a stand of small trees. I could see no occupants and assumed the vehicles were abandoned. Ahead, the road turned sharply to the left and circled downward into a wide valley. From the peak, I could see for several miles. I stopped the truck abruptly. Halfway across the valley, three or four military vehicles sat along both sides of the road. A small group of soldiers stood among the trucks. A chill ran through me. That was a roadblock. I backed off the crest and pulled my vehicle behind two large rocks, then got out and walked back to the overlook to again observe the activity in the valley. One vehicle was driving away in the opposite direction. Suddenly, I heard something behind me. I turned around quickly. It was Phil, the ecologist I had met at Vicente. He was equally shocked. "What are you doing here?" he asked as he rushed up to me. "I'm trying to get to Iquitos," I said. His face was filled with anxiety. "So are we. But the government's getting crazy over this manuscript. We're trying to decide whether to risk passing through the roadblock. There are four of us." He nodded to his left. I could see several men through the trees. "Why are you going to Iquitos?" he asked. "I'm trying to find Will. We got separated in Cula. But I heard he might be headed to Iquitos, looking for the rest of the manuscript." He looked horrified. "He shouldn't be doing that. The military has prohibited anyone having copies. Didn't you hear what occurred at Vicente?" "Yeah, some. But what did you hear?" "I wasn't there, but I understand the authorities rushed in and arrested everyone who had copies. All the guests were detained for questioning. Dale and the other scientists were taken away. No one knows what happened to them." "Do you know why the government is so disturbed about this manuscript?" I asked. "No, but when I heard how unsafe it was getting, I decided to return to Iquitos for my research data and then to leave the country myself." I told him the details of what had happened to Will and myself after leaving Vicente, especially the shooting on the ridgetop. "Damn," he said. "And you're still fooling around with this thing?" His statement jarred my confidence, but I said, "Look, if we do nothing, the government is going to suppress the manuscript completely. The world will be denied its knowledge, and I think the insights are important." "Important enough to die for?" he asked. The sound of vehicles attracted our attention. The trucks were driving across the valley toward us. Oh, shit, he said. Here they come. Before we could move, we heard the sound of vehicles approaching from the other direction as well. They've surrounded us, Phil shouted. He looked panicked. I ran to the truck and dumped the basket of food into a small pack. I took the folders containing the manuscript and placed them in the pack as well, then thought better of it and pushed them under the seat instead. The sounds were growing louder, so I ran across the road to my right in the direction Phil had headed. Down the slope, I could see him and the other men huddled behind a group of rocks. I hid with them. My hope was that the military trucks would pass and keep going. My truck was out of sight. Hopefully, they would think, as I did, that the other cars were abandoned. The trucks approaching from the south arrived first and, to our horror, stopped even with the vehicles. Don't move! Police! A voice shouted. We froze as several soldiers walked up from behind us. All were heavily armed and very cautious. The soldiers searched us thoroughly and took everything, then forced us to walk back to the road. There, dozens of soldiers were searching the vehicles. Phil and his companions were taken and placed in one of the military trucks, which quickly drove away. As he rode past me, I caught sight of him. He looked pale and ghostly. I was led on foot in the opposite direction and asked to sit near the crest of the hill. Several soldiers stood near me, each carrying an automatic weapon on his shoulder. Finally, an officer walked over and tossed the folders containing my copies of the insights on the ground at my feet. On top of them, he threw the keys to Father Carl's truck. Are these copies yours? He asked. I looked at him without answering. These keys were found on you, he said. Inside the vehicle, we found these copies. I ask you again, are they yours? I don't think I'll answer until I see a lawyer, I stammered. The remark brought a sarcastic smile to the officer's face. He said something to the other soldiers and walked away. The soldiers directed me to one of the jeeps and into the front seat by the driver. Two other soldiers sat in the back seat, their weapons ready. Behind us, more soldiers climbed aboard a second truck. After a short wait, both vehicles headed north into the valley. Anxious thoughts filled my mind. Where were they taking me? Why did I put myself into this position? So much for the preparation the priests had given me. I hadn't lasted a day. Back at the crossroads, I had been so certain I had chosen the correct road. This route was the one most attractive. I was sure of it. Where did I make my mistake? I took a deep breath and attempted to relax, wondering what would happen now. I would plead ignorance, I thought, and present myself as a misguided tourist, meaning no harm. I just got mixed up with the wrong people, I would say. Let me go home. My hands were resting in my lap. They were shaking slightly. One of the soldiers sitting behind me offered a canteen of water, and I took it, though I could not drink. The soldier was young, and when I handed the canteen back to him, he smiled without a trace of malice on his face. The image of Phil's panicked look flashed across my mind. What would they do with him? The thought occurred to me that meeting Phil on the hilltop had been a coincidence. What was its meaning? What would we have talked about had we not been interrupted? As it was, all I did was stress the manuscript's importance, and all he did was warn me about the danger here and counsel me to get out before being captured. Unfortunately, his advice had come too late. For several hours, we rode without anyone speaking. The terrain outside grew progressively more flat. The air warmed. At one point, the young soldier handed me an open can of sea rations, something like beef hash, but again, I couldn't force anything down. After sunset, the light faded quickly. I rode along without thought, staring straight ahead with the truck's headlights. Then I slipped into a restless sleep during which I dreamed of being in flight. I was running desperately from an unknown foe amid hundreds of huge bonfires, certain that somewhere was a secret key that would open the way to knowledge and safety. In the middle of one of the giant fires, I saw the key. I darted in to retrieve it. I jerked awake, sweating profusely. The soldiers glanced at me nervously. I shook my head and leaned against the truck's door. For a long time, I looked out the side window at the dark shapes of the landscape, fighting the urge to panic. I was alone and under guard, heading into blackness, and no one cared about my nightmares. About midnight, we pulled up to a large, dimly lit building constructed of cut stone and 2 stories high. We walked along a walkway past the front entrance and entered a side door. Steps led down to a narrow hall. The inner walls were also of stone, and the ceiling was constructed of large timbers and rough-cut planks. Bare bulbs hanging from the ceiling lit our way. We walked through another door and then into an area of cells. One of the soldiers who had disappeared caught up with us and opened one of the cell doors and motioned for me to enter. Inside were 3 cots, a wooden table, and a vase of flowers. To my surprise, the cell was very clean. As I walked in, a young Peruvian, no more than 18 or 19 years old, looked at me meekly from behind the door. The soldier locked the door behind me and walked away. I sat on one of the cots as the young man reached over and turned up an oil lamp. When the light hit his face, I noticed that he was an Indian. "Do you speak English?" I asked. "Yes, some," he said. "Where are we?" "Near Pulkupa." "Is this a prison?" "No. Everyone is here for questioning about the manuscript." "How long have you been here?" I asked. He looked up at me with shy brown eyes. 2 months. "What have they done to you?" "They tried to make me disbelieve the manuscript and tell about others who have copies."
"How?"
"By talking to me."
"Just talking, no threats?"
"Just talking," he repeated.
"Have they said when they will let you go?"
"No."
I paused for a moment and he looked at me questioningly. "Were you caught with copies of the manuscript?" he asked.
"Yes, were you?"
"Yes.
I live near here in an orphanage. My headmaster was teaching from the manuscript. He allowed me to teach the children. He was able to escape, but I was captured."
"How many insights have you seen?" I asked.
"All that have been found," he said. "You?"
I've seen all but the 7th and 8th insights. I had the 7th, but I didn't get a chance to read it before the soldiers showed up." The young man yawned and asked, "Can we sleep now?"
"Yeah," I said absently. "Sure."
I laid on my cot and shut my eyes, my mind racing. What should I do now? How had I let myself be caught? Could I escape? I concocted several strategies and scenarios before I finally drifted off to sleep. Again, I dreamed vividly. I was searching for the same key, but this time I was lost in a deep forest. For a long time, I had been walking aimlessly, wishing for some sort of guidance. After a while, a huge thunderstorm came and flooded the landscape. During the deluge, I was washed down a deep ravine and into a river, which was flowing in the wrong direction and threatening to drown me. With all my might, I fought against the current, struggling for what seemed like days. Finally, I was able to pull myself from the torrent by clinging to the rocky shoreline. I climbed up the rocks and along the sheer cliffs that bordered the river, ascending higher and higher, and into even more treacherous areas. Although I had summoned all my willpower and expertise to negotiate the cliffs, at one point I found myself clinging perilously to the rock face, unable to proceed any further. I looked down at the terrain below me. In shock, I realized that the river I had been fighting flowed out of the forest and gently up to a beautiful beach and meadow. In the meadow, surrounded by flowers, was the key. Then I slipped and fell, screaming down and down until I hit the river and sank. I sat up quickly in my cot, gasping for air. The young Indian, apparently already awake, walked over to me.
"What is wrong?" he asked.
I caught my breath and looked around, realizing where I was. I also noticed that the room had a window and that it was already light outside.
"Just a bad dream," I said.
He smiled at me as though he was pleased at what I said.
Bad dreams have the most important messages, he commented. Messages? I asked, getting up and putting on my shirt. He looked embarrassed at having to explain. The seventh insight talks of dreams, he said. What does it say about dreams? It tells how to, interpret dreams? Yes. What does it say about that? It says to compare the story of the dream to the story of your life. I thought for a moment, unsure of what that instruction meant. What do you mean, compare stories? The young Indian could barely look me in the eye. Do you want to interpret your dream? I nodded and told him what I had experienced. He listened intently, then said, compare parts of the story with your life. I looked at him. Where do I start? At the beginning. What are you doing at the beginning of the dream? I was searching for a key in a forest. How did you feel? Lost. Compare this situation to your real situation. Maybe it does relate, I said. I'm looking for some answers about this manuscript, and I'm damn sure feeling lost. And what else is happening to you in real life? He asked. I've been caught, I said. In spite of everything I tried to do, I've been locked up. All I can hope for now is to talk someone into letting me go home. You are struggling against being caught? Of course. What happened next in the dream? I fought against the current. Why? He asked. I began to pick up on where he was headed, because at the time I thought it would drown me. And if you hadn't fought the water, it would have carried me to the key. What are you saying? That if I don't fight against the situation, that I might still get the answers I want? He looked embarrassed again. I'm not saying anything. The dream is saying. I thought for a moment. Was this interpretation correct? The young Indian looked up at me, then asked, if you had had to experience the dream again, what would you do different? I wouldn't resist the water. Even though it looked as though it might kill me, I would know better. What is threatening you now? I guess the soldiers. Being detained. So what is the message to you? You think the message of the dream is to look at this capture positively? He didn't answer, he only smiled. I was sitting on my cot, leaning back against the wall. The interpretation excited me. If it was accurate, it would mean that I hadn't made a mistake at the crossroads after all, that it was all part of what should be happening.
This ends side one of cassette 5. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.